All right. Revelation chapter 19, verse 11. Where have we been so far, especially recently? Where have we been? Say it again.
Babylon
has been destroyed. Remember our fancy little chiasm that we had last time? Or not last time, but a couple times ago. Stretching from chapter 12 through chapter 20, we have a major chiasm. What is it? What first emerges in chapter 12? The dragon. Dragon in 12. And then what occurs? Yes, the two beasts in 13. And for the first time, what is mentioned in chapter 14? Babylon. Fallen is Babylon. Chapter 14. Then we go and we have the 15, 16 with the other bulls. And then 17, we have what? Or not 17, I'm sorry, 18. 17 to 18, kind of. But anyway. Yes. Babylon's destruction. I'm going to abbreviate. Then we have the two beasts destroyed where? Yes, 19, 11 through 21, which is what we'll be talking about today. And then we will also hopefully maybe get to today the dragon being destroyed, and that occurs in Revelation 20. Well, technically it's 7 through 10, but 1 through 3, 7 through 10 with a little spice of 4 through 6 in the middle, but we'll get there later. That's important. Why? Yes. The tip of the arrow of the chiasm is on Babylon. And why would it be on Babylon? Yes. For Asia Minor, that's what they're seeing most visibly every single day is Babylon. Babylon's all around them. Babylon is the one that they see manifested where the dragon, even though the beast and the dragon do exist, this is what they're actually seeing manifested in the prostitute that's ruling the world at the time. Okay? At the end, once Babylon, chapter 18, we went through and the destruction of Babylon, all the different reasons why they were destroyed. What was some of the major reasons why Babylon was being destroyed in chapter 18? What's that? Drunk on the blood of the saints. That's mentioned in chapter 17, and I would say that we could apply that to chapter 18 as well. What else? Persecution of the saints. The wealth was huge, right? Remember at the end of chapter 18, right before it goes into the hymn in chapter 19, it says, "You made the merchants of the earth the great men." How ironic is that? And then they said, "What'd you do with the saints and the prophets?" You killed them. You killed them. So the people that should have been the great men, the saints and the prophets, you killed them. And the ones that wouldn't have been the great men, you made the great men, and that's the merchants. Primarily, the exploitation of people so that more wealth and power could be secured. And the way in which these merchants and sailors and things of that nature did that was through their prostitution relationship with Babylon. Then we have this major hymn break out in chapter 19, 1 through 10, which we read last time, salvation, they're all going crazy. And then in verses 6 through 8, we have the great wedding banquet announced, the wedding of the Lamb. The bride is dressed in fine linen, because fine linen stands for what? 19:8? Righteous acts of the saints. Then the angel said, "Blessed are you who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb." John has a major faux pas in verse 10, in which he starts worshiping an angel. And the angel says, "What's wrong with you? Don't worship me, worship God." And that's been the entire... I think that scene summarizes the major point that we've been talking about in chapter 18. Worship God. Have the name of the Lamb and of the Father stamped on your forehead and not the opposite. Now verse 11. I am going to say this. I just bought a new Bible because my last one was stolen in the car. And it's NIV 2011 and they've done some funny stuff. So, if I come across some funny stuff, I may ask, you know, what does it say in yours? And if anybody wants to trade me, let me know because I want 2010 back. They're doing dumb stuff. Like, for example, this is one of the dumb stuff that they do. What is it? ESV. You know, I'm really thinking of switching over, which I really am. Because usually NIV is so widespread, I'm like, that's important. But 2011 has messed some stuff up. The very beginning of the Gospel of Matthew, it says, this is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. What's wrong with that? It's using a Hebrew word to translate the Greek word into the English. I'm like, just say Jesus Christ. Why are you switching that? It doesn't make any sense to me. At the beginning of Revelation 1 verse 1, instead of a revelation of Jesus Christ, it says from. Now, it could be from because of the way in which the genitive functions there, but of leaves it ambiguous, where from doesn't. Of could mean it is coming from Jesus or about Jesus, where from, you see what I mean by that? The word of could be about Jesus, or it could be coming from Jesus. But whenever you say the word from, you all of a sudden you make a stance that this isn't a revelation about Jesus, it's just coming from Him. Woo! I don't like that. So they're doing some funny stuff. They consistently translate Christ the Messiah, and I can't stand that. Because it's just not accurate. Anyway. There was something else in Revelation I just noticed the other day they did weird. But anyway. So if I come across something, just I may be asking you, what does it say there? Because it's not what it makes sense. What they're doing, just to kind of give you a philosophy behind the new NIV, that what they're doing is they're trying to move closer to an NLT type feel. The New Living Translation is a paraphrase more than anything. I mean, it's we're not trying to be accurate with the words. We're trying to get the understanding across. And I respect that. I really do. But NIV is trying to kind of have its cake and eat it too. And I'm like, you just need to pick one and dive into it. But instead what they're doing is they're subtly changing what they've always done, and I just don't think that's a smart strategy. Anyway.
Yeah, Wolf was saying that there's some good things, but there's also a lot of weird things. Like, yeah. Apparently they changed sinful nature, sinful flesh, which is good.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Because there's no longer that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And they have been doing the, I actually am cool with the gender neutral if the word itself is gender neutral. Now, or for example, whenever it says in 1 Thessalonians, we write to you brothers, it is intending to include sisters too. I'm okay with that, brothers and sisters, because that's what it means. However, there's other stuff I don't feel like that they're clarifying anything. I feel like they're actually taking a stance to make it more unclear, but whatever. Some stuff is theologically driven, but that's okay. Anyway, just pick who you are and be it. That's all. That's my whole point in that. So apply that to your life. Okay? Just pick who you are and be it. Okay. I saw heaven standing open. Who is I there? Who's the one seeing? John. I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and wages war. His eyes are like blazing fire. On his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one knows but himself. At this point, the name has not been mentioned to this writer, but who do we think it is? How do you know? Ah, because we've seen a lot of these descriptions before, haven't we? Chapter 1 has a lot of them, doesn't it? Help me. Where in chapter 1, or what are some of the things that we're seeing that we've already seen before? Eyes of blazing fire. Where would you see that as coming out again? Chapter 1, yes, verse 14. Absolutely. What else do you see?
Is it the name written on it?
The name that no one knows, or the name that no one knows. There is a veiled reference to that. In Revelation 3:12, Christ has a new name that it's not mentioned. So I could see that as a possible parallel, conceptual parallel. There is a name. The secret name is actually pretty interesting. Larry Pechaura actually brought this to my attention, and I haven't pursued it yet, but this is one of the things that's down, is that there is a strong precedent of Rome having a secret name or some sort of secret password that only the senators and the emperor themselves would know. And, matter of fact, I believe it's in Plutarch, we have one of the senators who tells someone the name actually being executed. Because the name was supposed to be secret. Why? What's the concept behind a secret name that would be emphasizing? Yes?
Well, you could call the god out of the city. Because they would go into the city, supposedly, and invoke the name of the god. And if you knew the true name, then you could call the god out of the city.
Yeah, that's part of it as well, definitely.
That's what I was in Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Yeah. There's, I'm not going to remember the Latin name for it, but there is a specific Latin name for that. Yeah. What else, though? If you have a secret name that you pass on only for the privileged people, what is that exerting? What is that insinuating? Absolutely. See, mystery is always connected with power. Always. As a matter of fact, I was talking to somebody, it was Jeff Snell. And Jeff Snell said this past weekend, and we were chatting at Missouri Christian Convention, and he said, I have a deep respect for people that are in positions of prominence, positions of authority, positions that are higher up than me. He said, not so much because of the person themselves, but he said, because of their access to information that I don't have access to. And his application of this was, whenever you're in the church, if you respect the people that are leading you, or if you're leading a church, if you give people a reason to respect you, then whenever you're making decisions that are tough for the whole church, people can stomach it a lot easier if they trust you. Because, bottom line is, there is always more information in a story. No matter what story you come to, there's always more information. And the people in the most privileged position, if you don't trust them, then that's the issue. But if you think, you cannot say in a situation that you don't have all the evidence of that the person was wrong. Why? Because you don't know the whole story unless you have the information, privilege to the information that really swings one way or the other. Does that make sense? But there is an exertion of authority. We are the only ones that know the name. We are the only ones that have the secrets to the mystery. Therefore, we are the ones in power. And Rome would use that with a secret name. That, to my knowledge, we don't know what the name was. But anyway. What else? What else do we see at these very opening verses that would point to Jesus?
Does like the white horse of India do it? Like, not like a horse, but the white?
We will come to what I think the interpretation of the white horse is either today or next time. But yes. Although, the only reason why I couldn't say white is only pure is because of the white horse in Revelation 6.
I was thinking to like his white hair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure. No, I see what you're saying there. Yeah. No, there could be. That one would be more on the fringes, but that definitely could be one. Yeah.
This isn't the only time that Jesus is called faithful and true.
Ah, it isn't, is it? Jesus has been called faithful and true once before, has he? He has. Revelation 3:14, Jesus, where Christ is called the faithful and true witness, which also seems to parallel somewhat of what we see in Revelation 1, verse 5. The concepts of him being the first witness. Him being the true revelation of God. Yeah. Okay, so what you're having here is you're having a picture being developed that we aren't given the name, but we know who it is. See what's happening? Or at least you know what side they're on, I guess we could say. He is dressed. Now this to me would be tipping me off a little bit more. I'm in verse 8, sorry. His eyes are like blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name. Oh, yeah, we've already read that. Okay, verse 13. He is dressed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God. Do we know more now? What's happening? If we go by tradition, who wrote John 1:1? In the beginning was the... And the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and in the beginning was the Word. Then John 1:14 says, and the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. It would make sense if this was in the Johannine tradition that he'd be talking about Jesus being the Word, doesn't it? And the robe is dipped in blood. We've talked about this before. But what is ironic about the where it is coming up in the imagery so far? What is ironic? What?
Got his judgment.
Yeah. His robe is dipped in blood, but the battle hasn't even been fought yet in Revelation 19, has it? No blood has been spilled in 19 in order for his blood to be, or for his robe to be soaked in it. So, I argued early on, what do I think this is pointing to? What's that?
The battle
is done. The battle has already been over. How do we overcome? How do we win? When did we win? At the cross and the resurrection. And that comes from Revelation chapter 12, verses 10 through 12, doesn't it? How do we overcome the dragon? By the blood of the Lamb. Here is the application point. The only way that Jesus can become the divine warrior on the white horse is if he first was the slain lamb. They always go together. That's how we win. Yes?
So whose blood is on the robe?
Yeah, whose blood?
Is it his blood or is it their blood?
Whose blood?
Or like the enemies of God.
Yeah.
Or is it both?
Or is it the saints' blood?
Could this be referenced?
And the answer is, yeah. I will say this. The weakest one of those three is the enemy's blood. And the reason why is because even though we had the reaping of the earth, the harvesting of the earth in 14, we haven't had it yet in 19, and this is a recapitulation of that. So the weakest connection would be the enemy's blood, because the battle hasn't been fought yet. And yet, the battle has already been won. It's kind of like the difference between D-Day and V-Day when you're talking to, you know, in the World Wars. D-Day was really the day the battle was won, but we had to wait several more months before V-Day actually came about. Same concept. So, is it Jesus' blood or the saints' blood? Well, chapter 12, 10 through 12 combines both of them of how we overcome the lamb, or how we overcome the dragon. He says, by the blood of the lamb and by the word of their testimony that they did not shrink from death. So, the first two I would land on more than I would the third one. However, can I say hard and fast that it's just the first two and not the third? No. Because we have proleptic prophecies and proleptic images in Revelation already. So it wouldn't surprise me if there was more. But Revelation 1:5, it does talk about Jesus freeing us by His blood. Revelation 5:9, He purchased us with His blood. Revelation 7:14, the great multitude washes their robes in the Lamb's blood. The Lamb's blood and the blood of the saints is the most prominent image so far in the book of Revelation. Although the enemy's blood does come up in chapter 14 with the great winepress. See what I mean? Good questions. All right. The point is what, though? What is the point? The battle has already been won. The battle's over. Battle's over. That'll be really important once we get to my interpretation of Revelation chapter 20, verses 7 through 10. The battle is already over. Okay. The armies of heaven were following Him, riding on white horses and dressed in fine linen, white and clean. Coming out of His mouth is a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter. Again, identity marker. Where else do we see that? He will rule the nations with an iron scepter. What's that?
Chapter 1.
And where else? 12. Yes, from Psalm 2. Remember in chapter 12, verse 5, whenever it describes the baby that is birthed from the woman? Says, and she gave birth to a male child who will rule the nations with an iron scepter. Messianic Psalm, Psalm chapter 2. And once again, it's saying, this is that same person. This is the Messiah. This is the King. This is Jesus. Coming out of His mouth is a sharp sword. Does that make sense biblically? Yeah, man. See, you come to points in Revelation whenever you start to say, okay, I know these are images, but I've seen these all before. Like, I've seen them before. Nothing drastically new is being brought out. It's the way they're woven together that is new. But coming out of His mouth, the sharp double-edged sword, we've actually even seen that in Revelation already once, haven't we? Where at?
Chapter 1.
And out of His mouth came a sharp sword. And once again here, out of His mouth comes a sharp sword, with which He will use to strike down the nations. I find that interesting as well. But the sword that Jesus destroys, as a matter of fact, this is fascinating to me in Matthew chapter 10, when Jesus says, don't suppose that I've come to bring peace. I've come to bring a sword. And we say, see, Jesus is violent. But what is the sword in that context? The gospel that divides brothers from brothers and brothers from sisters and sisters from sisters and children from parents. Right? It's that same sword, that same truth, that same gospel message that He will also use to strike down the nations. And they describe it in a very bloody, brutal way, but we'll get there in a minute. He treads the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God Almighty. That's where you could argue that the blood on His robe was the evil, the enemies. because that's the same imagery that we used also from chapter 14. On his robe and on his thigh, he has the name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Very interesting title, because nowhere in all of antiquity do we have any of the Roman emperors being called that title. But we do have the king of Parthia being called that more than once. All the time, actually. Even by the Romans. They'll say, you know, they'll be talking about, I can't pronounce his name correctly, but Vologesus, one of the key rulers or kings of Parthia, and they'll say, who calls himself the King of Kings and Lord of Lords? Or sometimes the Rome will even just say, you know, and the King of Kings and Lord of Lords will come and we will slay him. Parthia did call themselves that, and I find that quite fascinating. That the Babylon that was just been destroyed in chapter 18, in a sense, has a subversive, threatening message whenever this one comes along and he's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Yes?
Why is it written in the skies?
I don't have a great answer for that. The closest answer I've come across for that is that Octavian, whenever he was riding his battle, it was said that his sword was against his thigh, and it had some similar honorific titles, like the king over all the world, or things of that nature, that was specifically described as being along his thigh. Other than that, I really don't have a good answer. I really don't. If you find one, let me know. But no, that's the best I got. Yes? Say it again.
Like the covenant thing in the Old Testament, I don't know.
No, you're fine. Go with it. Don't be discouraged. Maybe. I mean, possibly. If I could see it argued more, then I'd be interested in that. But other than that, no, I don't really have that great of an explanation. Alright. On his robe and on his thigh, although I do... I do say, see, Jesus had a tattoo, so we're allowed to, too. Anyway, that's totally silly, but not really. verse 17, and I saw an angel standing in the sun who cried in a loud voice to all the birds flying in midair, come, gather for the great supper of God. And you're thinking, sweet, it's time for some food, the supper time. But you haven't read the menu yet. The menu is, so that you may eat the flesh of kings, generals, and the mighty of horses and their riders, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, great and small.
Those Christians are cannibals.
Yeah. All of a sudden, the great supper that the birds are going to be fleshing, or they're going to be gorging themselves on, is the flesh of who? Whom? I don't know if that's right. What's that?
Bad guys.
Yeah. The ones that were calling themselves the kings. Because Rome did call themselves that. They also did have generals. Actually, the literal word for that, generals, is ruler of thousand. So thousands being used in some sense in a figurative manner there. That's interesting. Because in five verses, people will say, thousand can't be used in a figurative way. Anyway. Generals and the mighty of horses and their riders and the flesh of all peoples, free and slave, great and small. No one is left out of this supper. And all of those describe those that have a particular mark on their head and forehand. Get it? Okay. Verse 19. Then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to wage war against the rider on the horse and his army. This is going to be significant. Because this is the second time we have a gathering together for a battle. Where is the first time? Yes, 16. And what was it called there? Armageddon. And was there a battle in chapter 16? No. And guess what? Chapter 19, there's not a battle there either. They gather for war, but instead of actually going to a war, they go to an execution. And this will happen one more time in chapter 20. Which is why I like to use the word at this point, we are recapitulating. Saying the same thing over and over with a particular reason, for a particular purpose, oftentimes involving intensification. What would be the reason for this capitulation right here? I'll give you a hint. It happens, climaxes in 2 to 3 verses. What is the major point of this particular capitulation? Say it again. Victory over the beast and the prophet. See that? Because we've already dealt with this. Now it's time to deal with this. This is the major focus. And it's intensifying though. Even though it's getting shorter, the imagery is becoming much more vivid and intense. And you'll see that. Well, we're about ready to eat a supper of people's flesh. Okay? If that's not intensification, I'm not sure what is. Then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to wage war against the rider on the horse and his army. But the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet who had performed the signs on its behalf. With these signs he had deluded those who had received the mark of the beast and worshipped its image. He's summarizing chapter 13 for us. Right, Tom? The two of them were thrown alive into the fiery lake of burning sulfur. That's brutal. I will say this. I don't know this. And please, those of you that did... Is anybody doing 19? Did I let anybody do 19? Did anybody have to trace the lake of burning sulfur or the lake of fire in the Old Testament? Anybody? Arrgh. I'll give somebody 3 bonus points that'll do that. Because I don't know if we have an Old Testament referent for a lake of burning fire or sulfur. But I found one the other day in Statius when I was reading some Roman material. And so that's interesting to me. That maybe one of the first times where the lake of burning sulfur or the lake of fire comes in Revelation in a context that seems quite Roman oriented. So anyway, anybody that wants to do that, let me know. Thrown alive into the lake of a fiery lake of burning sulfur. They actually had some weird traditions. They had some weird traditions in Rome when it comes to throwing people in just to a regular sea or lake. If you committed patricide, if you killed your father, they would say, "We're going to sew you in the bag." That was kind of their tagline that they would use. And what they literally would do is they would sew the person up in a bag. Inside of the bag would be a dog, a cat, a rooster, and a snake. And then they would throw you into the sea. And so as you're sewn in there, these things who are not fair, you know, really excited about drowning either in water are starting to bite and claw and do whatever they can, and you're drowning and being tortured at the same time. So the moral of the story is, don't kill your dad, okay? Because that's a brutal way to die. Or do what? Yeah, since they had sewing machines in Rome. That's good. That's a good try. I appreciate that. Yeah. The anachronism of your joke unraveled it as we spoke. Okay. And I'm rhyming. That's where we go. Okay. The rest were killed with the sword coming out of the mouth of the rider on the horse, and all the birds gorged themselves on their flesh. Now here's the question. Here's the question. What is the emphasis there in that last one? The word "the rest" is not good. Does it say anything else in anybody else's? Or no, actually the rest isn't too bad, but is there any other way that that's phrased in any of your English translations? The rest were killed? Or does everybody say the rest? Okay. Who did they gather together to make war? Kings of the earth, but who else? Remember, the summarization of chapter 13 is important here. Anyone that had what? Mark of the, that belonged to the beast, right? And the beast and the false prophet, or the two beasts, are taken care of by being thrown in the lake of fire. And then what does the rest indicate?
Those remaining?
Like, yeah, everybody else, right? That belonged to whom? The beast and the false prophet. Everybody. And what happens to all of them? What is all of their fate? They're killed with the sword coming out of the mouth of the rider on the horse, and all the birds gorge themselves on their flesh. Does it talk about survivors here?
No.
That will be important. And you want to know why? Because now we're moving into chapter 20, and a major question surfaces. What is the relationship between 19, 11 through 21 and chapter 20 verses 1 through 10? What's the relationship? Two options, primary options. One is progression, chronological progression. The other option is recapitulation. These are the two options, okay? Progression, the progressionist would say that this is chronologically, chapter 20 chronologically follows chapter 19. Why? Because that's the way you read it. Because 20 comes after 19. And I'll be honest with you, that is their most forceful argument. And on the surface, it looks good. if you haven't read or dealt with the rest of the book of Revelation. It looks really good. Makes a lot of sense. Why? 19 comes after 20. Therefore, the implications of that are that if 19 is the second coming of Jesus with the judgment, then 20 must happen after the second coming, hence the word pre-millennial. Right? You following me? Pre-millennial, and I'm using, like we were just talking about a minute ago, Greg, I'm using the most popular I get. There's mid-trib, post-trib, blah, 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 blah. But still, all of them agree that the second coming of Jesus happens before the thousand-year reign. Okay? Pre-millennial would mean that 19 comes before 20 when the thousand years is talked about. And on the surface, it looks good. Another one of their other major arguments, some other people try to come up with other arguments. These are their best two. I'm giving the best two because the other ones just, it makes them look silly. And I don't want them to look silly. I want to give them the best foot forward. First one is that the way you read it, 19 comes after 20. Second one is that the words Kai Adon and I saw, which begins chapter 20, is a, they would argue in the book of Revelation, is a indicator of chronology, chronological progression. That's the two best arguments, okay? And I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying that's the two best, okay? Now, here is the arguments for the recapitulation. Number one, have we been recapitulating at all in the book of Revelation so far? Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's been kind of the modus operandi. That's kind of what we've been doing all the time, right? How many times has the world been destroyed? Right? Yeah, quite a few. Chapter 14 is being brought up once again here in chapter 19. Isn't that some sort of recapitulation? Or does the harvest of the earth, everything have to happen after that? Recapitulation is not just a revelation phenomenon, it's a Bible phenomenon, isn't it? Does Genesis 2 not recapitulate Genesis 1? Doesn't it? Very first two chapters of the Bible, don't they recapitulate themselves? The creation account is told once again in chapter 2. What's the purpose of chapter 2? To retell it from a different perspective with a different focus, oftentimes involving intensification. And instead of just giving all 7 days equal weight, what most of the time do we spend in chapter 2? Day 6, right? Whenever man is created. And so is Eve. And all of a sudden we get a lot more details, like in one 24-hour period. I'm not saying anything about what my stance is on the 24-hour periods, but I do think that both sides need to know the fact that in one 24-hour period, Adam does have to name every single animal in existence and still have at least 30 minutes or so for him to fall asleep and Eve to be created. And then, bam, we made it just in time. Recapitulation. What about Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7? Don't those recapitulate? What about 1 and 2 Chronicles and 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Samuel? Aren't there some recapitulation happening between those books? What about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Aren't the Gospels recapitulating? Because you're telling it from a different perspective, with a different purpose? Yes? What else?
Even John recapitulating the creation story within this gospel.
Help me.
In the beginning. Mm. In the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't.
Word,
exactly.
Behold the man, on the, and then you have the eighth day.
Yeah. He retells the creation account in order to bring about a different perspective, and that is the existence of the Word and how it functions within there. Recapitulation is a very Jewish thing. It happens all the time. This is not something that a Jew would be like, whoa, what is recapitulation? They would say, ah, now you're speaking my language. And for a group that has a quite low literacy rate, and I know there's quite a lot of arguments around there, I've heard anything from 8% up to 30% literacy rate. I tend to lean more towards the 25%. 25% of people, maybe, in the ancient world could read. 20 to 25% is where I land usually. If that's the literacy rate, then the mental images of hammering home the same point over and over becomes all that much more important, doesn't it? When I'm speaking to you, do I not continue to speak the same things over and over from a different perspective? Don't I? Why? Because you don't have everything I'm saying written down in front of you. Do you? No, so you can't go back and check this. This is the moment whenever you get the information. Although I'm recording it, so I'm... See what I mean? So the first argument of recapitulation is, number one, how does the book of Revelation function so far as well as the rest of the Bible? That's the first argument. Second argument, the words Kai Adon for and I saw is not an indicator of chronology. Just trace it through the book of Revelation. It's not. And the question is how do you define chronology? Visionary? The visions that he saw? In other words, is it chronology in the sense of John saw this and then he saw this? And just because he sees one sequence to another, does that make a statement about the way in which those two different visions were even connected? See what I mean by that? You hear my question? Or do I need to recapitulate? In other words, if it says, and I saw, John saw, and he gives me a vision. This is what he saw. And then he comes along and he says, and I saw, and then he gives me another vision. Is he describing the relationship between the visions or when he saw them? See what I mean by that? Let's let language be a little bit more fluid than that. It's not like we have this hard, fast rule that every time he says Kai Adon, he's saying, pull out your roadmaps and write down henceforth what comes from my mouth. That's not what he's doing. He's saying, I saw this, and then the Spirit took me here, and then I saw this. And then the Spirit took me here, and then I saw this. And then, what are we tracing chronology? The chronology of the end of the world, or the chronology of what John was seeing? You see my question? To make this a hard and fast rule that Revelation 19 must be connected to 20 through a chronological roadmap because he uses and I saw is to make that language say more than what it's able to actually say. Do you hear my caution in that, or does that not make any sense? You see what I mean? It'd be kind of like me saying, you know what? I had a dream the other day. And in the dream, I was back in my house over in Joplin, and my kids were running around, and all of a sudden one of my kids hit his head, and then I saw myself back in my old house, back when I was a kid, and I was going through this, and I remember, and then I saw myself hit my head, and then I saw, and here's my question: am I tracing the visions that I saw, or am I tracing the chronology of those visions? Of when, in what order I saw the visions, not in what order the visions will occur or have occurred. Because in that particular example in and of itself, the first one was present time, the second one was past. Therefore, that breaks the chronology of the events all together. See what I mean by that? And I saw a great sign in heaven, and it was a woman clothed in stars. And yet, if that's the birth of Jesus, how could he chronologically be describing that happening in chapter 12? You see what I mean by that? If you take and I saw and make it, every time he says this, it must be chronology. You're making it say something more than what it is able to actually say. Yes?
I'm going to ask at the beginning of chapter 12, does it say and I saw?
And that's the question that you need to do. Trace and I saw all the way through. Kai Adon, that connection, all the way through. My point in all of this is he really saying this is chronology on a timeline, or is he saying this is the way in which I saw the visions? And honestly, if I'm reading it without a theological agenda, my would say, well, he's probably just saying he saw this vision and then this vision and then this vision. That would be the initial inclination. Yes?
Why would he just keep the progression of the story going at all? Why would he specify and I've seen something in addition to this battle that I just saw? Why is it just there was a battle and now an angel is coming type of thing? Why isn't it said in a single motion? Why does it separate like that?
I don't think I understand what you're saying.
Why does he say, and then I saw? Why is that a big deal if it's part of the same story that is going on?
Well, he doesn't say, and then I saw.
Kai Adon.
Yeah, and I saw.
Okay.
The word then, he does do that a couple of times, and that's a little different game. He does it in 19:1, he does it in 18:1, and then I saw. That's different. And then I heard, he says in 19:1. That's different. Because the word then is much more of a chronological indicator language. And I saw has none of that. See what I mean by that? Another point. Let's keep moving. Both sides agree that Revelation 19 and Revelation 20 allude and pull their imagery from Ezekiel 38 and 39. Ezekiel 38 and 39 is what? The battle of Gog and Magog. Actually, technically, it's Gog of Magog. But that's throughout Jewish history, Gog of Magog ended up becoming Gog and Magog, which was a way of them referring to the battle that end all battles. Anyway, that's just kind of a, you can trace the linguistic problems with that on your own time. However, this is interesting. If they are pulling 19 and 20 from a chronological roadmap that's laid down in Ezekiel 38 and 39, how come he doesn't pay attention to the chronology in Ezekiel at all? Because what you have is the battle of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 is actually a recapitulation of the battle of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 39. It starts over. The very battles in 38 and 39 is not one continuous battle. He describes it one way in 39 and then he recapitulates it in 38 and then in 39. Are you following me? Ezekiel 38, he's describing the battle of Gog and Magog one way, and then he recapitulates in Ezekiel 39. So if I was saying he was paralleling this in as it was, it would make more sense for 19 and 20 to be recapitulating if he's basing it off Ezekiel 38 and 39. Setting that aside, John disregards the chronology of 38 and 39 because Revelation 19, 17 through 18, the invitation for the birds to come to the great supper of God, is almost verbatim from Ezekiel 39, 17 through 20. You see that? So 19 of Revelation is paralleling the end of 39. And then what we have is we have Revelation chapter 20, 7 through 10. The depiction there parallels pretty clearly chapter 38. So if he's crawling chronology and it's based off of Ezekiel, then why in the world isn't he paying attention to Ezekiel's chronology just between these two chapters? It wouldn't have been hard. All he needed to do is pull out a scroll. He doesn't care about the chronology, I would suggest, because chronology is not his point. It's the picture. But there's more problems than that. And here is the major problem. Where do the nations come from in verses 1 through 3? It says Satan is bound and thrown to a prison. He's thrown into a prison to keep him from deceiving the nations. What nations? Because what happened at the end of chapter 19? Yet didn't it say in verse 21, the rest were killed by the sword. All of the rest of them were destroyed and the birds gorged themselves on their flesh. Where are they? Where are they coming from? What nations is he kept from deceiving? Weren't they all killed in the battle? See, if you're not recapitulating, all of a sudden you have to weasel your way in. Yeah, let me try to describe to you what the Left Behind series does in the book 13. I'm going to say try because it confuses me. In the Left Behind series, book 13, you have people that made it through the tribulation who do not have resurrected bodies. Therefore, over the 1,000 years, at the very end, Rayford Steele's body, at the very end of the 1,000 years, he's in a wheelchair, can't really see, can't really hear. His body is pretty much nothing, even though he's been alive the whole 1,000 years. Why? Because he doesn't have a resurrected body. So he's pretty much like a decrepit mess. That's one group of people. Another group of people is the people that had been raptured and now are resurrected in the 1,000-year millennium. And they're fine the whole time. They're fine. And the resurrected people can't have sexual relations with the unresurrected people because they can't mix like that. So even if you were married beforehand, if that person's resurrected, like Rayford Steele was, he couldn't be with his wife because she was resurrected and therefore she didn't deal with sex at all because she was beyond that. Now that's not even it. At year 99, every year 99, this is very important, this happens 10 times in the millennium, some people would die that were born in the millennium. They were born in the millennium, and they would die. And the reason why they would die is because at year 99, you would realize, because no one that is evil, I'm telling you, I'm not making this up, no one that is evil could not live past year 100. And so, at year 99, you would, on your 100th birthday, if you were good, then you would continue to live. If you were bad, you would die. And the last recapitulation of that, the last 100 years, so from year 901 to almost to the year 1000, That was the nations that Satan would deceive at the end. I promise. You see what's happening? What is happening is this. They don't know what to do with it, so they have to force it into a theological system. And so they make up stuff that we have no evidence for. But hey, when you just have 1,000 years mentioned, you can speculate whatever you want. However, do I want to say anything about that? Yeah, I got a couple minutes. Well, no, I don't, but I would say this. I think the overwhelming probability weighs in favor of recapitulation. It seems to be consistent with the rest of the book, the rest of the Bible. The images at the end of 19 don't allow for a non-recapitulation to occur in 20. You have to insert things in order for your theological system to work. I would rather just the images be painted, quit asking the theological questions, and allow the images to impact us the way we have the rest of the book. Therefore, I will take this as a recapitulation. You're allowed to disagree with me, but you'd have to tell me why, and it'd have to make sense. As a matter of fact, Grant Osborne, who does think that there is a literal 1,000 years, he's a historic pre-mill, he comes along and he basically says every argument for non-recapitulation, he says pretty much is foolish, but I'm still going to take that. I mean, he pretty much says the Chi Adon is a joke. Read his book. It's the EGNT. Is that what it is? The Exegetical Greek New Testament Commentaries. His big fat one. He is a historic pre-mill. But he basically says Chi Adon's a joke. He says he thinks that the biggest argument is just this is the way we read it literarily. It's just on the surface, you just go from one to the next. Therefore, if this happened first, this must happen second. To which I respond to him and just say, I think you're ignoring the way the whole Book of Revelation's function so far. So, what we're going to talk about next Friday then is if this is recapitulation, what is happening? How do we deal with stuff like what is the 1,000 years? What is the first resurrection? How could Satan be bound? Why is he released? We're going to answer all those questions hopefully next class. And more. All right. See you guys later. Love you.